It's Wednesday, March the 10th, and you're listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution, as well as a Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. Now, if my voice sounds familiar, that's a good sign, because that means you've been listening to my podcast for the past couple of years when we did them under the title under the guise of Area 45. But given last November's results, we can't do an Area 45 because it's no longer a 45th presidency. So we've rebranded. And that's what you're listening to now, Matters of Politics and Policy. By the way, we're not the only Hoover Institution podcast in town. There's Econ Talk with Russ Roberts, The Grumpy Economist with John Cochran, The Libertarian with Victor Davis Hanson, The Pacific Century with Mitch Oslin and John Yu, and Goodfellows with Neil Ferguson, H.R. McMaster, and John Cochran. That's actually the audio version of the broadcast that I do at those three each week. If you want to subscribe to any or all of those, very simple. Go to Hoover's website, www.hoover.org. Click on the Publications tab, then go on to the tab that says Podcast, and then you're on your own to subscribe as to what you want to do. You can also sign up for our monthly Pod Blast, which sends you the best of what we've done the past 4 weeks, and hopefully some of these podcasts will make the cut. So Hoover Institution Podcast is one part of Ideas Defining a Free Society. Now, if he's still there and he's lasted through the spiel, I'd like to introduce you to my friend Dan Moraine. Dan's a career journalist who's covered California policy, politics, and justice-related issues for more than four decades. That includes 27 years as a Los Angeles Times reporter and 8 years as editorial page editor of the Sacramento Bee, where he had to suffer making sense at times of my columns. But he's a good man. He always tolerated what I wrote. Dan is also the author of a new book, Kamala's Way, An American Life, the story of how a daughter of immigrants would go on to be the nation's first woman vice president, first woman of color to hold that office. Dan, great to have you on the podcast today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Bill. And I didn't suffer through your columns. I encouraged them, by God.
Yeah. Do you miss being an editor? Do you miss the newspaper business right now?
I do miss the newspaper business. The newspaper business obviously has changed dramatically. I was at the Bee for 8 years, like you said. I was editorial page editor for about half that, a little more than half that mm-hmm. time, and then a columnist and 27 at the LA Times. And the newspaper business has changed dramatically. I had a great run. I think journalism is changing in some ways for the better, and in some ways really not for the better. Diminution of coverage of state and local government and policy and politics, and that's not for the good.
No, it's not. Look, I can remember 25 years ago when I was working for Pete Wilson, who was governor of California, I remember the Los Angeles Times was just all over us. We worried about what George Skelton was writing about us in his columns. We worried about what a very intrepid reporter named Virginia Ellis was doing when she was digging the government. We were wondering what Dan Moraine was up to at all times. A very deep bench of reporters just really kind of snooping into government and holding us accountable. And that was a good thing, but not to knock the LA Times too hard, but the Times, all these publications have cut back. And with the exception of maybe Cal Matters, occasionally Sacramento Bee does good work too, but there's just not too many institutions really nosing into government the way it should be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the LA Times still has an important presence in Sacramento, and the Sacramento Bee does as well. What really has been lost in state house coverage, and I know you want to move on to other topics, is when I first moved to Sacramento from Palo Alto in 1991, there were all these one-person, two-person bureaus. The Chico Enterprise had a terrific reporter who dug into all issues, covered Chico from Sacramento. There was a terrific reporter from San Rafael. The Long Beach paper had a very good bureau, Bakersfield, California. And all these smaller papers had one or two person bureaus, and they really covered their communities from Sacramento. Nobody's really doing that for the smaller circulation publications, and that's a real loss.
Okay. Well, let's get to Kamala Harris, but briefly, just I want to get your thoughts on the health of Gavin Newsom, the political health of Gavin Newsom. You were watching his State of the State address, a very unusual one. I can't remember, Dan, the last time. So the governor gave a State of the State address on Tuesday night at Dodger Stadium. Good thing it went down south. It was raining here last night. That would have been uncomfortable. But he did it outdoors at the ballpark. And Dan, I can't remember. Well, I've been in California for the better part of over 25 years. I don't remember one being outdoors like that. It was a very different speech, and also I think a very political speech too.
Yeah, well, it sure was. It was, it was an empty stadium. It sort of looked like Dodger Stadium in the seventh inning, as a giant fan.
Well, the first.
You're right. It was a very political speech, and just think how different it was 1 year ago when he gave his State of the State speech. COVID had struck the United States, certainly had struck China, but he made no mention of it last year. It was a speech entirely devoted to homelessness and how California was going to confront the scourge of homelessness, the abdication of our collective responsibility. It was passing references in this speech to homelessness, and we can see that for a variety of reasons, homelessness has certainly become more visible in California and worsened in so many ways. Tent cities in Sacramento and certainly in LA. Governor Newsom is facing a recall. There's, I think, little doubt that it's going to qualify for the ballot. He's going to face voters most likely this fall. And then, of course, if he survives, would face voters again in 2022. I don't happen to think the recall is a very good idea, given that he is going to face voters again in 2022. That said, it's the law. It's what's going to happen. I think he can beat it. I think he ought to beat it. California is a very different state from what it was in 2003 when Gray Davis was recalled. There is no Arnold Schwarzenegger out there to really catch the imagination of voters in a way Governor Schwarzenegger did. And it's a much more Democratic state than it was in 2003. Yeah. The speech seemed rushed. It was, he seemed to gloss over a lot of points. It wasn't his best delivery. There were helicopters flying over, as always happens in Los Angeles, especially during rush hour. So it wasn't I'm not sure it succeeded in the way he might have wanted, but he got it done and he moved on, and ultimately State of the State speeches are not widely remembered.
And Dan, yet another sign of how decrepit the Republican existence is in California. Nobody sent a drone into the stadium while he was giving that speech.
Yeah, well, that would have been special.
No drone, no pangings of clanging of pots and pans, nothing like that. But so if there's a recall, it'll be later this year, Dan, and I'll be curious to see if one Vice President Kamala Harris comes out to campaign for him. So let's now talk about Madam Vice President. So the title of the book is Kamala's Way, and this is actually a very clever way that you have found to explain her existence. So when we talk about Kamala's Way, Dan, it's actually Kamala's Ways, plural, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, the title is... one meaning of it is her path to get from Oakland and Berkeley, where she was born and grew up the first 12 years of her life, to where she is now, a heartbeat away from the presidency. But then it's also her style, who she is, how she goes about her business. Multiple meanings. She is a forceful person. She's a thoughtful person, a strategic thinker. We know her in California, and this is, although the book is Kamala's Way, an American life, it really could be a California life. We know her in California as a woman in a hurry, which is what she has been.
Right. So Kamala fans, Dan, cherish her because of what she embodies, especially in terms of breaking barriers, cracking ceilings. Kamala detractors, though, ask the question. It's the Gertrude Stein question about Oakland. What there is there with her? So as in the course of writing this book about her, what conclusions did you come to in terms of her, in terms of really just kind of heft and substance? In other words, is there there with her?
Well, sure. There are core issues that she believes in. She's you know, she certainly is a true believer in the importance of civil rights and racial justice. Mm-hmm. That's a core belief. She is very much supportive of women's rights and mm-hmm. reproductive health, abortion rights, and such. Gun control is clearly an issue that she cares a lot about. There are a whole bunch of second tier issues and third tier issues where I think it's not altogether clear exactly what her views are. You know, she takes positions and doesn't take positions. She's very good at picking her fights. She doesn't engage in fights not of her choosing if she can at all help it.
Right.
Which is a sign, I think, of a very good politician, which is what she is, a very good politician.
Well, I think it's smart in this regard. The vice presidency, sure, it has limitations, but it also has advantages, Dan. And one advantage is just what you said. You can really just kind of choose your moment to surface. For example, if you heard her say boo about Andrew Cuomo in the last 2 weeks.
No. And why would she?
Well, exactly.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm sure she said something in private about him.
Yeah.
But this is not something that she's going to address.
No, but the point is, with that office, it's not like you're a senator or congressman chased down the hall every day by reporters, and eventually you get cornered and they have to say something. Kirsten Gillibrand's a good example of this. Eventually she had to say something. But Harris can really kind of pick and choose what to say about him or any other topic. So I think this is kind of a great thing. But this is a question. I want to get into her background in a second, but as we look at her right now, there's a question about what her portfolio is. In fact, Politico has a piece up on this today. We do know that she's talking to foreign leaders, so she seems very interested in embellishing her foreign policy. They had an interesting anecdote where she was in a White House meeting, Dan, on infrastructure, but then she had to leave the meeting to go to the Senate to cast a tie-breaking vote on the COVID relief package, and she was not apparently too happy about that because she wanted to stay with infrastructure. So how do you see her carving her portfolio? You know, this is based on her being an AG, based on her being a San Francisco DA. Obviously, she has in mind she wants to build up for 2024 if the opportunity is there. So what directions do you think she wants to take that office?
Well, the Washington Post did a piece a couple days ago about her really making a point of getting involved in foreign policy, talking to foreign leaders. So that's, I think that's going to be a big part of what she does. She has, you know, a unique position to really become a student of foreign policy in a way no other American really could. You know, Joe Biden has said he's a bridge to the next generation. I'm not sure. I understand the conventional wisdom is he's going to not run for a second term. I don't know. This is a man who's wanted to be
believe it when you
for
see
a
it.
Long time. And if he has the opportunity, I think he'll go for it again if his health is permitting. So whether she runs in 2024 or 2028, 2032, she's young enough to run in any of those years. Her portfolio is going to be what Joe Biden wants it to be. She understands that her path to success is his success as a president. I think she's not an independent player here. She has to be part of his team. She's smart. She understands that.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about her political ascent, Dan. She, in the course of 10 years, goes from getting elected district attorney in San Francisco, statewide attorney general. She's then reelected in 2014. Then the Senate comes up in 2016. And then in 2020, she runs for president. That doesn't work out, but then she's on the ticket. Now she's vice president. That's a pretty quick march in 10 years. Although I think about Richard Nixon, though, he pulled off a little less time, actually. He did in 6 years, I guess, from 46 to 52. But let's take a step back. back from 2010, Dan, and let's talk about actually her time before that as San Francisco DA and even leading up to the DA. What were the keys for her getting into politics?
Well, certainly she, well, first of all, let me say that this is an unauthorized biography, so she did not cooperate. And there are certainly questions that I would have asked her had I...
You had actually talked to her. I think you mentioned the book. You had actually sat down with her in Sacramento. And
Did she
comment on you eating fast or something like that?
She did. It is a failing. My wife comments on that as well.
But she didn't sit down. You didn't get a chance to stretch her out on the couch for the book. Yeah.
No. I mean, maybe as Governor Wilson will recall, I was never particularly an access journalist. I didn't want to become friends with people I was going to write about. And she's one who I wrote about a fair amount and specifically to not become friends with her if she even wanted that kind of relationship. Okay. It's hard to know exactly when she decided to enter politics. I know that in 1992, she was a deputy district attorney in Alameda County, and on election night, she got in her little Corolla and drove across the bridge to the Fairmont, where Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer were celebrating their victory, and that was the night Bill Clinton won the presidency. So she was thinking politics at an early age, and then of course she had her relationship with then Speaker Willie Brown.
Right.
He helped open doors for her without a doubt. That relationship ended in 1995. She decided to run for district attorney in at least 2002, maybe before that, but certainly in 2002. Her ascent was aided by really the some of the top donors in the city of San Francisco. Mark Buell was her finance chairman. If you look at her first campaign finance report, there are all kinds of really the elite of politics at that time in San Francisco. She had a tough race against Terrence Hallinan. He was a widely known, great name ID. She had virtually none. She ran a very good campaign. She did what you have to do in San Francisco, especially. She did your basic retail politics. She was out handing out brochures, knocking on doors, making her presence known with a big volunteer organization.
Her record as San Francisco DA, it's complicated. For example, you write about the episode with Isaac Espinosa. Would you like to explain who Isaac Espinosa is? And I'm also curious, Dan, as how this relates. I remember at the time this happened, Dianne Feinstein was quite upset, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So Isaac Espinosa was a San Francisco police officer doing his job, patrolling with his partner in the Bayview district of San Francisco, saw a couple guys walking down the street, stopped them. One of them had a semi-automatic rifle, turned around and killed Isaac Espinosa. That was in April of 2004. Harris had been sworn in January of 2004. She had run on a platform of opposing the death penalty, would promise to bring no death penalty cases, no matter the crime. So this was her first test. Sure enough, true to her promise, she refused to file capital charges against the killer of Isaac Espinosa. She did this before the funeral, probably not the smartest move, but that's what she did. At his funeral, and they filled up the cathedral in San Francisco. Police officers from all over the state were there. Kamala Harris was there sitting at the front, as was Dianne Feinstein. Feinstein, senior senator, stood up and basically said this was a capital case and and capital charges ought to be filed. Feinstein received a standing ovation. Harris was blindsided. This was utterly unexpected by Harris. So their relationship didn't get off to a great start. Feinstein had endorsed Harris' candidacy. She said that had she known that Harris would not have filed charges. She would not have endorsed her. They ended up obviously patching up that relationship. Her decision to not prosecute, to not bring death penalty charges, the capital charges against the killer of Isaac Espinosa haunted her throughout that first term. When she walked into the Hall of Justice, police officers would turn their backs. They were shunning her. But she ended up running unopposed for a second term. Feinstein ended up swearing her in for that second term. And then soon thereafter, she started running for California Attorney General.
Right. But before somebody paints a pattern of her as a very liberal San Francisco politician, you note in the book, she also sought to curb truancy by prosecuting parents of absent children. So there's a little bit of kind of a gas break going on here, it seems.
Yeah, she, you know, it is certainly the case that nationally, from a national perspective, Kamala Harris would seem to be a very liberal person.
Right.
In the world of San Francisco politics, though, she really wasn't. She was the Chronicle endorsement of her in 2003 was for Law and Order Kamala Harris. She ran to the right of Terrence Hallahan. There were issues where she could have gone further on being a so-called progressive prosecutor. Uh-huh. She didn't go there. She did not push, for example, to empty death row of the one or two people who were on death row from San Francisco. She did not advocate sweeping sorts of criminal justice reforms, you know, reform of three strikes, that sort of thing. She did not do that, which really annoyed her left. Right. The left in San Francisco, which is, as you know, is considerable.
Right. So in 2010, Dan, she runs for attorney general. I love political what ifs. For example, what if a few thousand votes in Georgia had shifted last November? There's no runoff for one of those races. The Senate's Republican, and that COVID relief bill looks a lot different today. The other what if, though, Dan, for California, 74,000 votes, which was a margin of difference in the 2010 attorney general's race. She got only 46% of the statewide vote. I did a little math on this. She got a million fewer votes than Jerry Brown did, who ran for his third term as governor, first one coming back. She received about 475,000 fewer votes than Gavin Newsom, who, like her, was leaving San Francisco. He was the mayor. He ran for lieutenant governor. She ran for attorney general. Not a mandate at all in 2010. What was the issue there? Was it a very good opposition campaign against her? I remember Steve Cooley was her opponent. He was the DA down in Los Angeles. But why did she lag behind the other candidates in that race?
Well, Steve Cooley was the one candidate the one Republican who really could have won, maybe should have won that year. That was the year of Meg Whitman. Meg Whitman's campaign really collapsed at the end, despite spending $150 million against Jerry Brown. Cooley was a popular district attorney, three terms in Los Angeles, really came across as nonpartisan, apolitical, received most of the newspaper endorsements, including mine at the Sacramento Bee. I wrote the editorial and took the lead writing the editorial endorsing Cooley for attorney general. He had built a reputation as being an anti-corruption fighter, very pro death penalty. He unlike Harris. If any Republican was going to win that year, it would have been Cooley. But Harris ran a very, you know, aggressive campaign. She went after him in a very significant way over really a blunderous answer as to whether he was going to take his pension and double dip, take his pension plus the salary of the attorney general. And then he had also taken some gifts. And so all this turned into fodder, and her campaign wisely just focused it on Los Angeles. She was going to win the Bay Area. She was going to win Northern California. What she had to do was narrow his margin in Southern California, and she ended up winning in LA County. So she ran a very smart campaign.
Yeah, she did. Actually, if you look at the numbers, Whitman was a disaster in Los Angeles County. And she was aggressive against Cooley, but Whitman just really dragged him down like an anchor in that county. So it's a fascinating what if. Where is she today if she loses that attorney general's race? Does she try again in 2014 or does she go down a different path? But so here she is now in 2011. She is the new attorney general for California. Dan, tell us what she does with the office.
Well, she could have done more with the office, but she comes in 2011. In 2011, California is still reeling from the collapse, the Great Recession. Her focus is on this litigation that the states have brought and the Obama administration has brought against the banks over foreclosures. She breaks from the pack, she and really Eric Schneiderman of New York lead this, and then Beau Biden becomes part of this as well. This is where she meets Beau Biden, and this is really important to her future. She and Beau Biden, Attorney General then of Delaware, become allies in this litigation against the banks. And that comes to serve her well later. Joe Biden remembers this after Beau Biden's death from cancer.
Right.
Remembers it well. There are issues that Harris, you know, might have taken a stand on. She doesn't. She true to her campaign promise, she did not defend Proposition 8. That was the initiative to prohibit same-sex marriages. Did, however, not take a stand on two measures that would have abolished the death penalty. This from a person who always had opposed capital punishment and wanted to speed up the death penalty. She took no positions on those. She didn't take a position on an initiative to basically roll back the three strikes initiative that was authored by Michael Ramos at Stanford. There are issues that she could have taken stands on, she didn't. Others that she did. She could have gone further, without a doubt.
And is she selective, Dan, because that's her nature? She is selected by nature and cautious? Or is she already thinking the next move, which we'll get to, which is 2016 in the Senate? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think both. Mm-hmm. I think yes to both. She is a strategic thinker. She doesn't take stands on issues that she didn't have to take stands on. She doesn't go out of her way to, you know, go out on too many limbs. There are exceptions. She did authorize the prosecution of an online publication known as Backpage.com, which was really a pretty gutsy move on her part, in my view. This was a classified ad publication online that basically advertised for prostitution. And she didn't so much care about adult prostitution, but she did care that many of the people marketed on this website were minors. And so she brought a prosecution, tested the bounds of California law. This was an area preempted by federal law. Lost initially, but then refiled the charges, and they're still pending in Sacramento. So it was a big issue, not one that any other state attorney general took on. She did.
Yeah. Let's go now to 2016, Dan, which is a pivot point for not just one, but two California politicians, both Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom. In this regard, as I mentioned, they're both out of San Francisco. One is lieutenant governor. The other one is state attorney general. They're both now getting national buzz. I think it's in April of 2013, if I'm not mistaken, that Barack Obama calls her the hottest attorney general in America, which is maybe not the attention she wanted, but hey, it's national attention. So anyway, now she's kind of on our radar as somebody who might be a rising star in national politics. Look out. But in 2016, Dan, there is an opening for statewide office. It's Barbara Boxer. She has been senator since, you mentioned, 1992. Kamala made that trip to the Fairmont Hotel. And she does something unusual in this day and age. At the ripe young age of 75, she turned 76 that year. She announces she's not going to seek another 6 years in the Senate, which, you know, I mention this because we have right now an 87-year-old senator in Dianne Feinstein and a 78-year-old president. And we have, you know, an 80-year-old, you know, Nancy Pelosi is also getting up there as well. So Boxer steps down and creates an opening. And this is important because it's the Senate, and the way California's moved politically, Dan, as you well know, these have become lifetime appointments for Democrats once they get in. So here's the question, Dan. Gavin Newsom is ambitious. He's looking for a higher post. Kamala Harris is ambitious. She's looking for a higher post. And there are two coming up. There's one immediately in 2016. And then there's one in 2018 because Jerry Brown, who's been reelected in 2014, he's term limited. So the two of them have to figure out who goes for what seat. So how does this play out? I've heard different versions of the story. So I want to hear yours now.
She had just been sworn in for a second term as California Attorney General, January 2015.
Right.
Barbara Boxer announces that she's not going to run. Less than 2 weeks later, Kamala Harris meets with her campaign team and come to the conclusion that it's put to her like this. It's back to our initial piece of this conversation about press coverage. News in America has become nationalized. So much of it emanates from Washington. It was put to her like this. Do you want to be Deval Patrick or Elizabeth Warren? Deval Patrick, obviously a very skilled and accomplished governor in right. Massachusetts, but not much well known beyond the Northeast, and Elizabeth Warren shaped national debate.
Right.
So she went for the U.S. Senate. Now, we know that she had envisioned running for governor. She had a campaign committee opened to run for governor, and she was contemplating it. But she decided that the Senate was the path for her. It opened up, and certainly it would have been had she run against Gavin Newsom for governor in 2018, I mean, that would have been a really unpleasant, tough race. I'm not sure who would have won that. She has said that she would have won it. I'm not sure that she's wrong, but it would have been a tough race. They worked out this agreement. He made his announcement that he was not going to run for Barbara Boxer's seat. And then right thereafter, Kamala Harris announced that she was going to run for Barbara Boxer's seat.
So it all worked out very neatly. They shared political consultants, didn't they? One of the stories here, there was basically, to use the Godfather metaphor, there was a meeting of the families and they sat down and the deal was cut. She would go for the Senate, he would go for governor. But it sounds like you don't go along with that narrative. It sounds like she decided Senate and that he did governor.
They had a phone conversation the Sunday night before he made his announcement. I don't believe that Kamala Harris or Gavin Newsom are controlled by their consultants. I think that they have their, I think they're both pretty headstrong. But I also thought that she saw a big opportunity in the Senate. A U.S. senator from California is going to find her way to Iowa and New Hampshire soon enough, yeah. And maybe sooner rather than later.
And let me point out an important difference about the job now versus then, Dan. So I worked for Pete Wilson, who before he was governor of California was a two-term senator. He actually left in his second term to run for governor in 1990. And he, Dan, occupied what was called the jinx seat because it kept on changing after 6 years. Somebody new would come in. And he was elected in 1982. He defeated Jerry Brown in 82, and he was up for re-election in 88 against Leo McCarthy, I believe, the lieutenant governor. And he was running rather scared for those 6 years. He wanted to make sure he was not a victim of the jinx. So Dan, every Thursday, he would do his best to hop on a plane to get back to California to spend the long weekend with constituents. And this was very complicated back then because National Airport did not have direct flights. Reagan Airport did not have direct flights to California. You'd have to get out to Dulles, which involved him dragooning somebody in his office, speeding on the Dulles Parkway, usually getting a ticket as a result of that. State troopers not too impressed that he was a California senator. The point is, because California has shifted, Dan, because there is so much Democratic job security, that Democratic senator doesn't really have to be on California soil that much. And if you doubt me, watch Dianne Feinstein. If she does weekend television shows, more times than not, she's in D.C. and not California. So there's a certain security with that job now. Boxer left it after 24 years. Kamala Harris could have had it for the rest of her life, I think, as well. So I think that gives you latitude to get in and start going national, which it seems to me, Dan, she arrives in Washington in 2017. And man, it just seemed like before you know it, she was up in the Hamptons giving talks and looking very much like a presidential candidate.
Well, yeah, but it really started on election night, 2016. I mean, she assumed, as most of the rest of us assumed, that Hillary Clinton was going to be the 45th president of the United States. She had written a speech, an optimistic speech about working with the Clinton White House. Mm-hmm. Well, that didn't work out. She tore up that speech and very quickly put together a very different speech, which you watch it on YouTube. It's a pretty good speech. It is a fight speech. She declares right off that she is going to be part of the resistance, a significant part of the resistance, and she's going to fight on behalf of Black Lives Matter, and she's going to fight on behalf of immigrants and people who have come here without papers and so on. She's going to fight Trump at every turn, and she does. And that really is what defines her time in the U.S. Senate. Is, you know, she didn't do water policy. She didn't, you know, she put her name on a bill related to water. That wasn't her thing. Her thing was being a part of the resistance to Donald Trump.
Right. And the Kavanaugh hearing.
Well, it wasn't just Kavanaugh. It was now Justice Kavanaugh. She went after him in a serious way. Jeff Sessions, she tongue-tied him. William Barr, she was pretty tough on him. And then a bunch of other Homeland Security people, appointees who she ripped. and then Brett Kavanaugh, of course. Right. So yeah, that's how she... She certainly built a following that way, you bet.
Right. And then she goes national, she runs for president. And again, it's complicated, Dan. On the one hand, she makes a mistake that losing campaigns often do. They have operations set up two places where people are making decisions. She has people in California making decisions. They set up an office in Baltimore to make decisions. And the Jeb Bush campaign had this. They had people in California and they had people in Florida. And the story is told, Dan, they hated each other and they'd fly to Dallas to meet each other as a result. So that's dysfunctional. So she, on the one hand, she kind of lays the grounds for dysfunction. On the other hand, they lay a very clever trap at the expense of Joe Biden.
Yeah, well, so she understood that it was a long shot. Her candidacy was a long shot. She was running against some very talented politicians, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, and Joe Biden. She understood that her pathway to victory went through South Carolina. She had to win South Carolina. That would give her momentum going into Super Tuesday in California. Right. In particular, and all the other states, so in order to do that, she had to hobble Joe Biden, and in that first debate, she went after him in a very serious way over his stand on busing to achieve school desegregation. We remember that because she said she was that little girl. And right thereafter, of course, her campaign put out
T-shirts already made
merchandise. So, you know, of course it was pre-planned. Of course it was. But the goal was to knock Joe Biden office purchase frontrunner. She was not running for second place. She was running to win the nomination, and she was running to win the presidency. And the way to do that was to hobble Joe Biden. It worked for a minute. It didn't work for very long. And her campaign, you're right, there were rivalries. I mean, I wasn't on the campaign trail, but in piecing it together afterward, clearly rivalries between Baltimore and California, between her sister Maya, on whom she relies, who's her most trusted confidant, probably other than her husband Doug, or their equals. The campaign just really never took off. It started out really well with her big rally in Oakland, 20,000 people, lots of banners, lots of bunting, but it just didn't take off. She didn't raise money in the way she had hoped.
But she had a moment, Dan, where she scored a big hit in that first debate, and her numbers went up. And granted, these are pre-primary poll numbers, so they're like mercury, right? They change fast. But she did take off very quickly, but then she ran into trouble. She went back out on the road and started getting asked questions about Medicare for All and where she was, and she couldn't handle the moment.
Yeah, well, she was in two different places on Medicare for All. She had written an op-ed in which she talked about the need for it, and then walked that back. She was an uneven candidate. There are, lots of candidates who run for president, and very few who win the nomination, and obviously very few still who win the presidency. She, not unlike many candidates, will run again. My guess is she'll be a better candidate the second time around.
I would point out one thing about her 2019 experience. She did one thing very smart, Dan. She got out quick. She got out early. She got out before she was embarrassed in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina. So that's one reason why she didn't necessarily have the L on her forehead, because she was gone before the voters decided. But so she ends up on the ticket with Joe Biden. So your hunch as to what the attraction was there for her?
And you should add to the, she would have lost California. That really would have been embarrassing. And more than that, it would have weakened her in a re-election campaign in 2018. Joe Biden narrowed the field by half by saying he was going to pick a woman. And so that meant she was in the running. And she was a front runner from the beginning, without a doubt. And then George Floyd died under the knee of a Minneapolis cop, and that really changed the equation. It changed politics, certainly Democratic politics, and it became, I think, imperative that Vice President Biden pick a running mate who would be who was a person of color. And so that really came down to a very small number. It was Susan Rice, Stacey Abrams, Karen Bass, Congresswoman from Los Angeles. But Kamala Harris was the one who had run statewide. She had won statewide in California, not an easy thing to do. And she had run for the presidency, and she had been vetted. She had been vetted by reporters, by serious investigative journalists. She had been vetted by opposition researchers, Democratic and Republican opposition researchers. I know, I read their files. So she was, just to me, it became pretty clear that she was the front runner. It wasn't at all certain that he was going to pick her, though. In fact, leading up to that weekend, before the Tuesday when he made his announcement, there was a great deal of speculation that it was going to be Susan Rice. But then he came down, and part of that was. A well of support she has here in California that was made clear by our Lieutenant Governor, Eleni Konalakis. She organized a phone call in July to the Biden headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware, where she put on the phone several prominent Democrats, Michael Tubbs of Stockton and Gray Davis and Mayor Garcia of Long Beach and others. And they all gave a 60 or 90 second statement as to why Kamala Harris had support and why she would be good for the ticket. And I think that that mattered a lot.
Yeah, I think it served one other purpose. You look at Joe Biden, Dan, and what I see is a stopgap president, if you will. He's not transformative in his beliefs necessarily. I don't think he's a movement politician the way you could say Obama was or even Reagan back in the day. He's a stopgap. He's an anti-Trump stopgap. So there's a question about the Democratic Party moving forward after Biden, if it's 4 to 8 years. So question, Dan, what direction do you think Kamala Harris wants to take the Democratic Party?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that Biden's necessarily a stopgap. I mean, I do think he's a transition. I think he has said he's a bridge to the next generation.
I just say stopgap in terms of, number one, he's not out there. He's not out giving talks. He's not putting his face in front of things. He is not getting you to buy into a cult of personality, number one. But then secondly, if you look at his positions, he moves in between things. For example, we don't know where he is on the filibuster, for example. Mm-hmm. He wants a different version of Medicare for all. He's not necessarily at the hard left of the party, but he's also not necessarily an old school Democrat. He's kind of in between, Dan. That's what mm-hmm. I mean by stopgap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I do think the COVID package is going to be a big deal. But at any rate, what kind of leader would Kamala Harris be?
Yeah, just your sense on she would be young, she'd be relatively undynamic. A face you want to put on coins and a name you want to put. Good question, by the way. Does she qualify for a school in San Francisco, or is she on the bad guy list?
Who knows about a
transformative figure if she were elected president, but then the question is, where would she take her party with her?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't believe that Kamala Harris is, she's certainly not the radical that Donald Trump might have us believe, have voters believe she is. She spent a lot of years putting people who did horrible things in prison for a long time,
Right.
I think that has an effect on people. So I think she has this sort of, she it was, for Law and Order, vote for Kamala Harris for DA, right? So I think she has that element to her. I don't think, I think her foreign policy ultimately becomes kind of a mainstream Democratic view. Mm-hmm. I think she would be, take a dim view of Vladimir Putin. Is going to be supportive of Israel,
right?
But also is going to try to figure out a path to Middle East peace. I mean, God knows.
Does she have a relationship with Bernie and AOC?
Well, I'm sure she has a relationship. I'm not sure what kind of relationship she has with AOC. I'm sure she talked with Senator Sanders. They were both in the Senate together and both mm-hmm. on the campaign trail. But Sanders is to the left of her without a doubt. I think ultimately she would be a little bit to the left of Joe Biden, but not dramatically so. Just look at her stance on reproductive health, on gun control, on civil rights, on immigration. These are ultimately what now is more of a mainstream Democratic view, pathway to citizenship. Without a doubt, she's thinking about that. She clearly wants to get DACA recipients legal status. These were the things that she ran for, in her Senate campaign.
Okay. Obama had Axelrod and a group of smart people around him. Bush had Karl Rove. Does Kamala have a brain that she turns to, an architect, a certain political mind who helps her steer through things?
Well, certainly Ace Smith has been with her he was her chief strategist when she ran.
A. Smith is a veteran Democratic consultant.
Yes, Bay Area. And Sean Clegg. I mean, these are people who have been with her when she ran for attorney general both times in U.S. Senate and were part of her presidential campaign. Part of it is, we'll see how that plays out in the years ahead. I mean, I do think that A. Smith has a special place in her world, but we will see when she runs in 4 or 8 years, who that team includes. I know it will include Maya Harris, her younger sister,
right.
and no doubt Doug Emhoff, her husband. We'll see. I'm not sure that she's dissolved her campaign account, which is smart on her part. Mm-hmm. I know that she's in touch with Californians. I hear from them.
Right.
I know she's not forgetting where she has come from.
Well, this is kind of the beauty of politics, Dan. And if we'd had this conversation in February 2020, you might have said, gee, Kamala Harris, ran a bad presidential campaign. I don't know if she'll get on the ticket or not. I'm not sure what her future in national politics is. And you would have said at the same time, wow, look at Gavin Newsom. Things are good in California. He's riding high. He has Donald Trump as a pinata. He's a serious player in 2024. And here we are a year later and things have changed.
Well, that's true. I do, this is way too early, but I do think that people should not count out our new senator, Alex Padilla, as a national figure.
Okay.
Nobody would have said that a year ago.
As a rival to Kamala.
Oh, not necessarily a rival to Kamala Harris, but they're both young enough that
he would have to.
There's room for them all.
We're playing a lot of chess here, but he would have to let her run in 2024. She'd have to lose, and then he would step in 2028. And, finish what she started.
There are different scenarios one could dream up.
Okay, that is very interesting. So. You write in the book about Cali. This is not the California version of Cali, C-A-L-I. This is Cali with a K, K-A-L-I. Cali is a Hindu deity. How does Cali relate to Kamala Harris, Dan?
Well, so I found this really quite interesting. So in her first interview, she made reference to, first interview was running for district attorney. She made reference to the to this goddess, mm-hmm. Kali, and so look up Kali, K-A-L-I. She's this fierce warrior. She's got heads, a necklace of heads, and arms on her skirt. She's wielding a sword. She's got a severed head in her hand. There's a body under her foot. so she's this, she's this very fierce warrior. She's also a mother figure. Ah. And so Kamala Harris viewed herself, I think probably still does, as this fierce warrior who's also got this maternal side. If you think about her in those terms, I think it helps define who she is, what she is, how she views herself.
And is she that person? Is she that warrior? Does she decapitate people?
Well, I don't know. Ask Jeff Sessions how he felt after that that episode before the Senate. But yeah, she can be very tough. She can be very, very tough. She can be tough on her opponents, as many of them have learned, mm-hmm. and she can be tough on her staff, she's also got a real empathetic side. She's got this is not a heartless, bloodless woman. She reaches out to people in need who are in her world, in ways that right. I certainly was unaware of when I was writing about her from the Sacramento Bee and then right. a little bit at the LA Times.
No children of her own, but she has stepchildren through her husband. Tell us a little bit about the marriage.
Well, isn't it a California story? So Doug Emhoff's a divorced guy, lawyer, high-powered lawyer, high-end lawyer in Century City. He has a client, Rex Hudland, and Rex Hudland's wife, Chrisette, come to visit him for legal advice at the end of the session. Chrisette Hudland says, so are you single? And he says, why are you asking? Well, I got a friend who you might like. Who's the friend? And she says, well, Kamala Harris. And Emhoff says, who? What? How do I know that name? You know, it's such an LA story that a high-end LA lawyer would not know who the attorney general is. But then he realizes, oh, it's her.
No way. Meghan Markle didn't know who Prince Harry was. So
there you go.
this one sounds a little more credible. But
yeah. So as he tells the story, he's at a Lakers game and he texts her and invites her out to dinner or whatever. And so they're off to the races. What an LA story, just a schmo lawyer, hardworking lawyer, but you know, divorced father or two, gets introduced by Hollywood royalty to the attorney general. And isn't it a typical LA love story?
I think Bumble is, by the way, headquartered in Santa Monica, I believe. So this is, you're right. This is Pardon very, cal- I think Bumble, the dating service is headquartered in Los Angeles, by the way. So it's, this is a very California thing. It's in Santa Monica.
It is. And then, and so Doug Emhoff is, obviously has a good relationship with his ex-wife and so she's part of this sort of extended family, I don't know. And they have two children who evidently call Kamala Mamala. So she didn't have a large family, but
what a modern family.
What a California family story that is.
It is a California thing. You talked about her staff. Her staff could be pretty tough too. Just ask the good people. I think it was Vanity Fair, wasn't it, that ran afoul of the Harris operation? Wasn't there a flap before the election about how they photographed her, what she was wearing?
Was it Vanity Fair or?
One of those magazines. I may be getting wrong. Maybe it was Elle or Cosmopolitan, but I think something. The flap was over. She was what wearing? I think.
Well, she was being very informal. She was wearing her chucks, her tennis shoes.
Yes, exactly. Not glammed up.
Well, not befitting the office of the vice president. And I thought it was kind of a silly sideshow, but. The whatever the publication was changed the cover photo to make it a little more formal, a little more befitting the august office of vice president.
Well, that's what struck me. Her people pushed back very hard, and the magazine relented very quickly. They did not want to get on the wrong side of her. I think that's kind of an interesting question moving forward, Dan. Are the press going to take any critical look at Kamala Harris, or is she going to have a pretty smooth ride during the Biden presidency?
Well, it's interesting. The LA Times has assigned a reporter, Noah Berman, to cover her full time. That's his job. Yeah. And it was kind of interesting. You saw blowback from critics who don't know anything about Noah Berman saying, oh, this is just, he's going to give her a free ride and, make sure she's comfortable with, give her pillows to sit on, this sort of thing. That's not Noah Berman. So he's written some pretty tough stories. But then also he's describing her ascent. I think it's a great beat, and it's really smart of the LA Times to have somebody assigned to her in this way. One thing that I do know, one thing that I did find when she was attorney general is. She understands the nature of the press, and you're not always going to write. Pieces that she likes. She seemed to be not have a particularly thin skin when it came to press coverage.
Not a thin skin.
No, she was not thin skinned. And I know this because, if you go back and read what I wrote in 2010 about her 2011-12, her early years as Attorney General, you know, I was not particularly kind to her. You know, she still came around to talk to the Sacramento Bee. So anyway, that was my experience. There will be people, but it's also the nature of the changing business, the nature of the changing news business, is I do think that there's a blurring of the line between news and opinion that right. bothers me although I've been an opinion journalist, was at the Sacramento Bee. More of my time has been spent as a straight news reporter, and it does concern me the blurring of the lines. So she may find more friendly voices to talk to. I think that's maybe human nature, certainly politicians' nature.
Okay, let's wrap up this conversation, Dan. I sure appreciate your time today. If Hillary Clinton were vice president right now, I think the memes of her lying in wait for Joe Biden would be just vicious. Mr. President, taste your food. Mr. President, don't take that drink from her. I don't think anybody has assigned that kind of motive to Kamala Harris, but there is a serious question here, Dan. If the president, you know, starts losing his fastball and we start having these, you know, rumors, these conversations about the 25th Amendment, the same as we had with Trump, given what you know about Kamala Harris, what you've studied, could you see her kind of in the middle of this sort of intrigue, or would her style be more to let cabinet secretaries drive the train?
Yeah, no, I don't think she's. I would just be shocked if that happened. I think Jill Biden, might play such a role, but you know, I just think that the stuff about Biden losing his faculties, I mean, it just ages to me. I mean, yep. the guy won the presidency. You don't do that if you're losing it. It's really hard to run for president.
Right.
These other people who ran and never got to, you know, first base.
Pete Wilson barely got to Labor Day in his, but there's actually a serious question here. And that's, it's one that unfortunately occurs to women when they run for office. We quickly slap labels on them. And, you know, oftentimes labels aren't flattering. Somebody is ruthless, which is what Hillary has been tagged with. Sarah Palin's basically a bimbo, just these very bad characterizations. But how do we characterize Kamala? Because she may be ambitious. You may say she's hyper ambitious if you want to, but I'm not sure that ruthless comes to mind. Based on what I've read from your book and what I know about her and what I've read, ruthless, scheming, no, it just doesn't seem to be that kind of person. But yet she's a politician, so there has to be some element of opportunism in there.
Well, sure, of course she is. She's certainly ambitious, and I don't know a single politician who's not ambitious,
right?
I mean, including people who are on school boards and city councils. So yeah, she's ambitious. She has been a woman in a hurry. She has elbowed people aside. All that stuff is true. But I also think that you know, truthfully, we could do worse. We could do worse than Kamala Harris's vice president.
Okay, final question.
And we have done worse.
Okay, final question for you, since at all times I'm obsessed about California politics. Can you explain how the pyramid works out here now? You've had a governor at the top of the pyramid. The governor is in political troubled waters right now. Here you have a former senator who would have been below him on the pyramid, but she's now the vice president of the friggin' United States. When it comes to endorsements in California, Dan, when it comes to, let's say, the Los Angeles mayor's race, which is coming up next year, who's the bigger player here? Is it the governor or the vice president?
Oh, without a doubt, it's the vice president.
The Veep.
Oh, sure, of course. Right. I mean,
But does she have that kind of power within California, Dan, to anoint people, to carry them over the line?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure she's going to do that very often.
Right.
You know, you didn't see Barack Obama endorsing too many people in Illinois. He did endorse Kamala Harris for Attorney General in 2010, which was actually a pretty interesting move on his part. So, Yeah, I think without a doubt, Kamala Harris is riding high now. It's really hard to be governor, as Gavin Newsom is finding, and it's probably one of the reasons why. It's hard to be governor. This has been an extraordinary year, just an extraordinary year. I'm not sure too many governors would have fared well. Your former boss probably would have managed it in interesting ways. Jerry Brown would have, but this has been a really tough year. So we'll see how Gavin Newsom does. I would not bet against him.
Again, I would point out the listeners, politics, things change in a hurry in politics. I can easily map out a scenario where Newsom survives the recall election, survives it rather healthily this fall. And then guess what? Next year, he steamrolls to a second term. And who knows what happens in Washington if the Biden administration goes off the rails for some reason, if there's an international crisis, a domestic crisis, and it appears that they're not really in charge of the situation, her stock could go down, his could go up, Alex Padilla's could go up. So, you could be writing a book about Alex Padilla or even a book about Gavin Newsom very soon, which does beg the question, Dan, what's next for you?
Oh, That's an interesting question.
You're too young to stop writing. You only have 40 years in the service.
Yeah. Well, there is plenty to write. What I know is stuff about California. So whatever it's going to be is going to be some sort of California focused piece of work.
Well, you just have to write out Dan Walters. That's all.
That'll never happen.
No, we've had Dan on this podcast. He is really a treat in the institution. And how many columns have you written over the years? Have you done a head count like Dan has?
No. I mean, I haven't written nearly as many columns as I have news stories. I know that at the LA Times, I wrote more than 3,000 stories. But nobody's going to match Dan Walters.
It's like the Ty Cobb of California writing, right?
Lou Gehrig or something.
Yeah. Hey, Dan, I enjoyed the conversation, and keep writing about Kamala, keep writing about this crazy state of ours. There is I know because I write for the Washington Post now, there is an appetite for the rest of the world to try to make sense of California. So we need your voice.
Yes. Well, good luck with that, trying to figure out California.
Okay, Dan, enjoyed the conversation very much.
Thanks so much, Bill.
You've been listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance, the balance of power here in America and around the world. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. And if you wouldn't mind, spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online, as I mentioned, at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover Fellows to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's spelled @HooverInst. Dan Morane, brave man that he is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @DanielMorane. Daniel spelled as you might expect it. Morane spelled MORAIN, @DanielMorane. The book, once again, Kamala's Way in American Life. We'll be back soon with another installment of Matters of Policy and Politics. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.